The Dharma, incomparably profound and exquisite, is rarely met with even in hundreds of thousands of millions of kalpas. We now can see it, hear it, accept and hold it. May we realize the true mind of the Tathagata. Today is day 3 of this 7-day session here at Mountain Gate in October 2015 on a beautiful fall day, as we often have in New Mexico. And I'd like to share with you some more of the writings and thoughts of Jacques Lusserand, the blind Frenchman who had a deep awakening experience in Buchenwald. You heard already that even as a child, after he'd gone blind, he began to realize that there was a way of going within, where he was able actually to see in a certain sense. He could actually describe the size of a tree and how far away it was, for example, things like that. And you heard as well that when he tuned in inwardly and let himself relax and be at ease in life, he could see quite well. Not in the same way that we see, but certainly well enough in his own way to be able to get around. He even went hiking in the mountains as a teenager, although he always went with friends. And you heard as well yesterday, that even a few weeks after the accident in which his eyes were removed because of the damage that was done to them when his glasses broke, when he was inadvertently shoved and fell into the corner of the teacher's desk when everybody was rushing out for recess, that when they were at the beach, he was running and playing and climbing and making sandcastles and swinging and going down the slide and running around with all the kids as if there was no problem. He was able to access that deep inner quiet knowing place. And you also heard that if he were to get anxious or jealous or needing to be number one, that suddenly it vanished. And he was no longer able to find his way around. That, as he put it, things rearranged themselves. And he would bump into them and get hurt, and it was a very different way of being than if he was really let go and tuned in. And this says something about our own ability as well. Most of us depend on our eyes and our ears. We live facing out, so to speak, with a focus outward. As children, as small children, we're often not 100% in that direction. We often have an inner sense as well. But certainly by the time we are going to school, teachers are telling us to pay attention, and the parents and teachers alike are trying to get us out of the habit of what they call daydreaming. And so we begin to learn to focus outside ourselves and to adopt a way of living and a way of thinking about things and seeing things that society considers appropriate. It's interesting that, I don't know if it's still a practice, but in some Native American tribes, at some periods of time, when their children would get to the point where 3 and 4 year olds do get, where they always ask why. Why is the sky blue? The best thing you can do if a child asks you that is turn the question back to them. I don't know. Why don't you look up at the sky and see if it'll tell you? Because what the Native Americans would do when the kids were starting to ask questions, that they would say, go out into the forest and sit very, very quietly. And if you're sitting quietly enough, the trees and the bushes will tell you the answer. And here we are, trying to reach that mind state inside in the Zendo, because it has tremendous benefits. I'd like to share with you a little bit here of some writing by Jacques Lacerande, in which he describes a little bit more about being blind. This is from a book called And There Was Light. And it doesn't say, at least on the cover, who translated it. Oh, yes, it does, Inside, by Elizabeth Cameron. And it was published by Parabola Books. And it was published in 1987. But it was first published by Little Brown and Company in 1963. And Jacques Lacerande held the copyright at that point, which is very interesting. Because he and his wife later died in a car accident. A very short time after I went blind, I forgot the faces of my mother and father and the faces of most of the people I loved. From time to time, I remembered a face, but it was always that of a person I did not care about. Why did memory work that way? It sounds as if he was so at one with his parents that there is no image making as part of that process. And when we are at one with life, with what we're doing, there is no image making as part of that process. It's something to consider. Could it be that affection or love puts us so close to people that we are no longer able to evoke their image? Perhaps we never see those we love, never completely, just because we love them. In the absence of their faces, I had the voices of my parents ever present in my ears, and since the accident, the shape of people and their appearance still concern me, but in a different way. All at once, I stopped caring whether people were dark or fair, with blue eyes or green. I felt that sighted people spent too much time observing these empty things. Every cliché of colloquial talk, quote, he inspires confidence, quote, quote, he is well brought up, close quote, seemed to me superficial. The froth, but not the drink itself. As we grow up, we develop our own self-image based on how people react to us, things that happen to us, and our assumptions about why and how and so on. And we gradually develop a fairly hardened self-image. And that image gets bumped into, and one way or another, we find ourselves embarrassed, we find ourselves getting angry, we find ourselves getting upset. Why? It's only an image. Who is the real one? Who is the real one? The great Chinese master Rinzai said, there's a true person of no rank going in and out of the doors of your senses. If you haven't seen it yet, see it now. See it now. As a true person of no rank. A person of no rank. No standing, no image, no specialty. Going in and out of the doors of your senses. If you haven't seen it yet, see it now. See it now. Who is this true person of no rank? Where is this true person of no rank? Rinzai added, and in the eyes it becomes seeing, in the ears it becomes hearing, the tongue it becomes tasting, the hands it becomes holding, the feet, it becomes carrying us. This true person of no rank. For my part, back to Jacques Le Seran, I had an idea of people, an image, but not the same as the one seen by the world at large. Often I saw them in a way diametrically opposed to that of others. The furtive boy I saw as shy, the one they called lazy, as struggling all day long in imagination with an ardor that was the opposite of laziness. To tell the truth, my opinions of people had become so different that I often distrusted them. I ended up feeling that I was the one who was strange. And as we go more deeply into our practice and become more clear in our own seeing, we find that we may or may not be in step with the rest of humanity, at least not most of humanity. For society has their ideals, their images. Buy the right lipstick, and you'll have a wonderful life, and you'll be popular, and you'll get married and have super little kids, and live happily ever after. Get the right car, and you'll be successful in your business. Wear the right clothes, and people will admire you. There's a book by a British man called Blowing Zen. Blowing Zen because there is actually a tradition in Japan of Zen monks whose practice is to play the shakuhachi for hours on end. And they normally wear a basket over their heads, a particular basket that's got a slit for eyes so they can see where they're going, so that they're anonymous. And that is their practice. Blowing Zen, playing the shakuhachi. And this man, who had everything that society told him was what was necessary to become successful in the world. He had a fantastic job. He had an apartment in the right part of town. He had good friends, went to nightclubs often, lots of entertainment, lots of parties, and life was empty. And he began casting around for some way of having it less empty. And he saw an advertisement in a newspaper, of all places, in England, in London, I believe, that advertised a week of peace and serenity in a Japanese temple. And he took them up on it. Well, it turns out it was a sesshin, but it was not the usual kind of sesshin. It had a fair amount of free time in it, and the location was pretty incredible, as Japanese Zen temples can be. And it was the time of the year where it wasn't too cold or too hot, so he didn't have to deal with that. And so he went, and during some of the free periods, he was wandering about in the gardens of the temple and came upon a Japanese man playing shakuhachi. And he sat and listened and became very interested in this, and asked the man, they had a little conversation, and asked him about playing, and said he'd like to learn to play, and the man gave him his card. Well, it turns out to be one of Japan's foremost shakuhachi players, but he didn't realize that at the time, and did look him up, and started taking lessons, and actually moved to Japan to learn the shakuhachi. And he got the knack of it and found himself deeply engrossed in learning to play this rather difficult instrument. To play it is not so different from our susokan, extended out-breath practice, because it is a definite extended out-breath practice to play the shakuhachi. A lot of breath control. And he was learning fairly rapidly. And then he decided, he learned about the blowing Zen, about the Zen monks who played the shakuhachi as practice, and he decided to emulate them. And he decided that for 6 weeks he would go up on a mountain every day, and for at least 6 hours he would practice the shakuhachi. And he did this, and it was quite amazing, the depth of control that he got over the instrument, and also the clarity of mind that he began to open to. And his shakuhachi teacher, whom he did not share this secret with, was quite impressed by his progress. Eventually, he became a shakuhachi performer. But his old life, the high life of London society, he abandoned to play a simple flute. And there he found the richness he was lacking in the life that everyone had told him would be one that would bring him great success and great happiness. We Zen folk, in some ways, are a little bit like the people in the movie The Matrix who were not caught in the web, who had awakened to a little bit more of reality. And so one of the things that can happen is we don't fit as well in society because we don't buy so completely anymore society's values. We're more interested in something deeper and more free, more generous and compassionate, more wise. And the Zen practice, if we do practice it on a regular basis and for long enough, will open us more and more and more to the mind states that make that possible. It still may be that we'll become a doctor or a lawyer or an engineer or someone else that society calls successful. But in doing our work, we will do it in a way that it'll be far more fulfilling than if we had just gone for the title, for the glory, for the idea. And back to Jacques. Frankly, hair, eyes, mouth, the necktie, the rings on fingers mattered very little to me. I no longer even thought about them. People no longer seemed to possess them. Sometimes in my mind, men and women appeared without heads or fingers, and then again, the lady in the armchair suddenly rose before me in her bracelet, turned into the bracelet herself. There were people whose teeth seemed to fill their whole faces, and others so harmonious they seemed to be made of music. But in reality, none of these sights is made to be described. They were so mobile, so much alive, that they defy words. People were not at all as they were said to be, and never the same for more than 2 minutes at a stretch. This is another thing to recognize. Things are not fixed. We tend to depend on life as being fixed. We do this and it'll bring that result. We do what society tells us we do, and in order to be successful, and we'll be successful. And I think of how many turns there are in people's lives. Think about Shido Bunan suddenly having to raise an infant that was not his, disdained by the village. And then a year later, admired deeply because of how he dealt with it. I think of the men who did trading in bonds and stocks in the 1920s, in 1929 when the crash occurred. Their self-image was so destroyed hurl themselves out of buildings, committing suicide rather than living with the pain of the loss. We never know what's going to be ahead of us in our life. And particularly now, we don't know. With all the chaos in the world, with all the bizarre and violent shootings that are taking place. This last one in Oregon, which simply seemed to have been accomplished because the young man who was a loner wanted glory, and he mistakenly assumed that glory came from the more people you could kill. He saw this by what was put out in the newspapers every time there was a killing. And so he decided to get that glory for himself. What a terrible misunderstanding of life. This image that we carry around about ourselves. Who's the real one? The image is a shell. Who are we really? It's vital to find out, because that is what brings us true and lasting freedom, regardless of what comes forth in our life. To continue, people were not at all as they were said to be, and never the same for more than 2 minutes at a stretch. Some were, of course, but that was a very bad sign, a sign that they did not want to understand or be alive, that they were somehow caught in the glue of some indecent passion. That kind of thing I could see in them right away, because not having their faces before my eyes, I caught them off guard. People are not accustomed to this, for they only dress up for those who are looking at them. People only dress up for those who are looking at them. What would it be like if we didn't have the constriction of the self-image that hampered our movements, that limited our activities, our responses to life, that hamstrung us, hobbled us as we go through life, sometimes able to feel pleasure and of course, it's balanced by the opposite. And the irony is, it's only a story. It's only a set of ideas. It's only a set of conclusions. It's only a self-image, a picture. Who are we really? That's what we need to find out as soon as possible, so that we can truly live. Truly and freely live, no matter what karma brings to us. And that's basically the primary lesson of Zen. We open to this self-image little by little by doing the practice. It shows us where we're caught. It shows us who we think we are. And gradually we begin to see more clearly who we really are. And then we also recognize the responsibility to offer this to all others. Not to go out and yank them in and say, here, you sit down and you'll become free eventually. Not to proselytize at all. But when our own minds are clear and unhindered, that communicates readily to everyone around us. And and other people are able to be more free as a result. As we free the caught places in our own minds, so that also helps others become free. This is the Bodhisattva vow, the way of the Mahayana, the great vehicle, where we don't do it just for ourselves. We do it for all beings so that everyone can share in this freedom and joy, in this truly living of life. And I thank you for listening. We'll stop now and recite the four vows.